Posloucháte podcast Praktici. Uvádíme rozhovory praktických lékařů se specialisty v kontextu personalizované medicíny založené na důkazech. Zaměřujeme se na vzájemnou spolupráci, zakopáváme příkopy. Ke každému dílu sdílíme relevantní zdroje a odkazy na vzdělávací akce pořádané Institutem postgraduálního vzdělávání ve zdravotnictví. Dobrý den, vítáme vás u podcastu Praktici. V dnešním rozhovoru tady mám vzácného hosta, paní profesorku Lien Rowe. Hello, Lien.
Hi.
It's so lovely to have you here, and it's such a gift for our podcast to have so many great guests who can inspire our still very, very much under the way of development system of not only general practice, but also of the education of GPs.
Oh, that's so kind. Thank you so much for the warm welcome. But actually, I love the Czech Republic, and my husband was born here. We have a family connection, so it feels very natural for me to be back here, and I love it. So thank you for your warm welcome.
So it's really a lot of pleasure to be able to talk to you, and today we would like to focus on the differences maybe and on the inspiration we can take from Australia, where you come from, because you've also visited many Czech practices in the past 2 months.
That's right. Yeah, I've met many Czech GPs, which has been great.
But more than that, you've done and you've worked all your life in the field.
That's
and
right.
And you have gone through the system from many views. So you can help maybe even us to see some things that could help us on the way and share with us some of the knowledge you have gathered throughout your professional life.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for that. But actually, the first thing I'd like to do is to acknowledge every general practitioner in the Czech Republic, because from what I've seen of general practice here, GPs have been so courageous, particularly during the pandemic and as we're emerging from the pandemic. And I see a lot of innovation here. And I think that, in fact, Australian GPs can learn a lot from the inspirational courage, but also the motivation to make things better and to do things differently and to change things for the better. I am going to go home next week to Australia with a really renewed enthusiasm for my work after meeting so many GPs here, and I'm really eager to share what I've learned. So I wanted to make that acknowledgement first up.
That's great to hear and very rewarding. I've come to the feeling that most GPs all over the world and even most doctors all over the world were facing very similar problems. So as it comes to discussions, we find that the topics are quite the same, and the problems we have had with ourselves and with our patients.
I think we have more in common than we realize. I think we've learned that. And I think that we've been reminded that we develop very strong bonds with our colleagues when we share adversity together. And so if that's just one of the small positives that have come out of what we've faced in the last 3 years, if we can create stronger bonds and stronger relationships with each other to support each other through this really difficult and challenging career that we've chosen.
So for our listeners, maybe could you explain what was your way through medicine? How did you start and how did you develop throughout your professional life?
Okay, so I've had a long career. I graduated in 1980 and I did my first intern years in regional hospitals, and then I moved into rural general practice with my husband, who I mentioned was born in the Czech Republic. And so we set up a rural practice together from scratch in a town that had never had a doctor before, and it was really hard work. I learned a lot about it. I feel that I gained great insights into people and into life and into medicine over those early years of my career as a rural GP. I was delivering babies and looking after people at home, palliative care. I was the first attender to car accidents and emergency situations. So it was really the full range of experiences as a rural doctor, and it was really challenging, especially as I had a young family at the time and not a lot of supports. So I look back at that time and think, I'm not sure how I survived that, but I can only say that I learned a great deal, and it gave me a great foundation for what I do now. So what happened after that very quickly, though, was that my husband and I had been working in our practice for about 10 years when we actually both felt really burnt out. And now that I look back on that, it's not surprising, is it? Because after 10 years of being on call and night duty and so on, of course you would feel worn out and tired. But I remember at the time that we judged ourselves very harshly, and we were actually thinking of leaving the practice and working elsewhere. So we did take a year off the practice, which was actually a hard thing to do, and we travelled around Australia, and we actually worked in Aboriginal health in far north Queensland. And that was a year that really changed my life. And after I worked with Aboriginal people, I saw poverty in my own country that I had never been aware of before. It really woke my social conscience, and it made me understand that I could, that what I was doing in my consulting room was actually very valuable, but it was a responsibility to step outside the consulting room and actually advocate, and to become involved in creating awareness of what was happening in Indigenous communities. And so that was actually a time when I started to write. Mm-hmm. I hadn't ever thought that I was a good writer before that, and I didn't understand I had a little bit of a talent for it. But I just started to write about my experiences, and people started to read it, which was a great encouragement. And from that time I've always written, not only to advocate for patients, but actually as a therapy for myself, because it helps me express the frustrations of what I feel and the things that need to change. So we might park that and come back to that another mm-hmm. time, because I can tell you about my books, but it's been one of the joys of my career to be able to sit quietly on time off and reflect deeply about my experience and actually to write about that and to have that published. Anyway, after that experience, my husband and I, we did go back to the to our rural practice, but I actually stepped aside. I just worked a few sessions a week rather than full time, and I stepped aside and I did other roles, and I set up a clinic for homeless youth in a large regional town, and I worked in that clinic and worked with many other GPs in that clinic for about 10 years, and I gained great insights into the issues for homeless youth and the really complex issues like mental health and mm-hmm. sexual health and drug and alcohol issues and so on. And that was a very rewarding time in my life. I also wrote a lot about that time, and I developed a great interest in parenting and mental health from that time, and I did my Doctor of Medicine with Monash University. So again, it strengthened my writing skills. I also learned back then, it was a shock to me, or just an insight to me, that the homeless young people that would come into the clinic on their own, often they'd be as young as 13. They were actually from all socioeconomic groups. They were from the poorest areas of the regional town, but they were also from privileged families, including doctors' families. And sometimes I saw my colleagues' children at that clinic. And that's one of the very significant memories I have of that time, the tragedy of doctors' families falling apart because of the work stress that they experienced. And it left a really a marked impression on me and made me think very deeply about what we can do to prevent that in the profession. And that's probably why I then became very interested in the topic of doctors' health. And so for the last 10 or 20 years, I've worked through the college and through a number of other avenues on researching, teaching, writing about doctors' health and how we can transform how we look after ourselves as carers. So I also, through that journey, and this was not, I didn't seek this, but because I had to do all the things that I was uncomfortable with, like public speaking and writing submissions and writing, you know, for grants and things like this. I hadn't had any experience in anything like that before, but I had to do it because of the work that I was in was so underfunded that it was just a necessity. And through all of that work, I started to get tapped onto the shoulder. I had to advocate to government, for example, and then I got tapped on the shoulder for government roles or leadership roles connected with the government. And then I was also tapped on the shoulder for board positions with health companies. And so I've actually had a lot of experience as a director of a whole range of different health-related companies, which has given me major insight into how to cut through health bureaucracy and politics and actually make a difference at the leadership level of an organisation. And I'd very much like to share those experiences because it haven't been easy. It hasn't been easy to do that. And I have to say, as a female, it's sometimes been quite mm-hmm. difficult. I've faced discrimination and so on. But perhaps because I've learnt the hard way of how to come through those challenges, maybe I have something to share with other people about how to make that a bit easier. So I, just to summarise, a rural practice, homeless youth, doctors' health, leadership roles in health in health-related organisations and work with government. But through all that, I've continued to write and advocate. And I'm very much of the belief that if you align yourself with like-minded people, you can't do it on your own. You know, this is not, I'm not on sort of a crusade or a personal crusade, or but to actually develop bonds with like-minded people and unite with like-minded doctors to advocate for better patient care, you know, there couldn't be a more satisfying thing to do when you actually see the results of that advocacy. And one of the great things about being a GP is that we follow people for a long time in their lives, don't we? We provide continuity. And so you see over decades, it takes decades, you know, sometimes actually in your consulting room, in the general practice, it can take a decade to actually make a difference, to help make a difference to someone's life, can't it? Say, for example, with a drug addiction or something really intractable, it can take a long time to actually hang in there and make a difference. And I think it's the same with other issues in our healthcare system. Sometimes it takes a decade or more of perseverance to actually make a difference at a leadership level. And it's, you know, it's hard to persevere when, you know, it can be lonely or it can be frustrating or it can be bureaucratic. But actually, you know, I think it's really important that we seek to have a purpose in our lives and we find meaning in our lives by actually trying to make a difference at a leadership level. And so I always encourage people that if they have that opportunity to do that, that they need to take that, you know, they need to take that opportunity and see where they can go with it, you know, take it almost as an experiment to see how far it goes. So that's a long answer to your question, but it's actually been a long journey.
Very inspiring. And I so many questions come to my mind, but I need to ask this one. So what was your husband doing all this time? Did he stay in the office in the rural practice?
Well, actually, this is a very important question, because we've always been great supporters of each other. And I feel that it's almost would have been impossible for us to manage our individual careers without each other. Without each other's support and the ability to debrief about what we do. And he has given me the greatest support to go on and to really explore my own way in my medical life. But we've also worked together, which has been a great joy. So my husband has been mainly a rural general practitioner and a very busy one. You know, he's the person who's there earliest in the morning and late at night. And so he worked very hard over, really 3 decades until he became very unwell himself. And he was unfortunately diagnosed with prostate cancer, which was in about 2009. And it was a very aggressive prostate cancer. So the news wasn't very good to start with. And that gave us a great shock because, we had a lot of people depending on us in the rural community, and he was unable to work because of all the treatment that he required. So that's when he gave up the rural practice and we moved to Melbourne, which is a major city in Australia, for his treatment. And we both started to do some work as well. We were still able to work part-time through that. Actually, as it happened, and I know I can share this with you, because his prognosis was quite poor, we decided that we needed to seek treatment elsewhere, and we actually came to the Czech Republic for his treatment, mm-hmm. and he accessed a very successful immunotherapy, and it really changed both of our lives. So he needed time off work, significant time off work over this period. But now, because he's so well, he has returned to part-time work, and he mainly specialises in musculoskeletal medicine, and he really enjoys that. But I think that his whole experience with having a major illness as a doctor has really changed our thinking, and really, it's shaken us up. But because we've been able to, come through that in many ways, it's also given us a lot of strength and motivation to support other doctors, and to actually share what we've learned and to support others. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's really what has brought us back to the Czech Republic. So my husband, I might have explained earlier, he was born in Olomouc. He left Czechoslovakia when he was 14 with his parents, and they immigrated to Australia. They were refugees, and he was he couldn't speak English when he came to Australia. And within 2 years, he was on his feet, he learnt English, and he got into medicine and at the University of Melbourne. So, it was very hard work for him and very difficult for the family, especially as his father died only 12 months after they arrived in Australia. Mm. So it was really difficult for his mother. So, his past life has been quite, I could say very challenging. I think in many ways it's gave him the motivation for really working hard as a doctor and doing his best for his patients. And then when he became unwell himself, you know, to actually take that illness as a way of learning about his life and what he could contribute in the future, and then completely changing his approach. So, you know, I admire him very much, and you know, I think that we've developed a very strong bond with each other through adversity, and I feel now more than ever, you know, we have a love for life and a real gratitude for everything that we have. Yeah.
Well, it's so moving to listen to, and thank you so much for sharing. It would be another very interesting topic to discuss how doctors go through severe disease.
Yes.
I have actually been reading a lot of stories about doctors who were very sick themselves and had some experience both in the Czech Republic and abroad. And these stories are a very great source of inspiration for doctor-patient relationship.
Yes.
Because once we become patients, we experience our own medicine, and
that's right.
We are exposed to the other side.
Yes,
and
it's quite a shock actually to be on the other side and to wait in other doctors' waiting rooms. It's not easy. So we've developed quite a number of strategies to get through that. But you know, I think that we've also always knew this, and I think we always strove to be kind, humane doctors. But you know, it's a real prompt when you're on the other side to really remember how important kindness is and how important caring and humanity are. My husband has consulted doctors who are burnt out, and I can tell you that doctors' burnout impacts patient care. You know, it's really not easy to be on the other side of a consultation as a patient when you're consulting a doctor who is clearly burnt out and not caring or not giving the you know, the kindness really that every patient deserves. It's really tough. So I think that's probably another motivating factor for the work that I'm doing at the current time.
And this we would very much like to discuss in the other part of our podcast series, because it's a very one of the key topics now in medicine. But let us return back to the comparison of the Czech Republic GP practices and the ones in Australia. Have you found some similarities during the past years, maybe, or decades in Australia regarding the topics we are now trying to solve here in our system?
I think we have a lot in common, actually. There are differences, though, and I'm interested in your feedback, because I don't like to make a generalisation. You know, I have met many GPs in the Czech Republic, but of course it's not the same. It's not the same experience for everyone. So you'll have to correct me if I've made some assumptions that aren't right. But what I see is that doctors here are very well. I think doctors here, as I've said, have been very courageous. You've had a difficult time in the Czech Republic through the pandemic, but now there seems to be an energy about trying to make things better and try to manage practices so that they can efficiently serve their patient populations. So you have a different model of funding in the Czech Republic compared with Australia, and that's more capitation funding. So You're being paid for your patient population rather than per service, whereas in Australia it's the reverse, where we're mainly paid for fee mm-hmm. for service. What I've observed in the Czech Republic is that you're using practice nurses really effectively and efficiently, and that they're highly skilled.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we are as effectively using the skills of nurses in Australia the
so
way we should.
So who does their job?
Well, we do have nurses, but I see that the practice that I've visited, especially throughout the rural areas of the Czech Republic, have shown me that the nurses see the patients first,
mm-hmm.
that they do a workup, and so the vital signs are there, or appropriate questions are asked.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the doctor comes to see the patient, the doctor quickly reads what the nurse has been able to find out, and it makes it so much easier for the doctor to then do the consultation,
mm-hmm.
Because the background has already been set for you.
It's very individual. It's different. Doctors do it in different ways, and there are many practice settings. I would be interested in how it is in Australia, but we have different models of practices. Mm. So there is still a lot of practices one-to-one.
Yes.
Like our office is a small one.
That's right. Yes. So. And I have been visiting a lot of solo GPs.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in that. But they have the nurses or other professionals in the office, but they might be mm-hmm. only one GP, especially in the rural areas, I guess, where there's a shortage. But
yeah. So sometimes we have one nurse, one doctor in the same room,
mm-hmm.
and that means the patient first talks to the doctor shortly. Then the doctor decides what the nurse maybe can work on the patient a little bit and to make the diagnosis more secure and to decide on the right therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the patient returns back to the doctor to discuss the results, of POCT methods or some other examinations.
Right.
So it can be done differently, but the truth is that the nurses are efficient, but still we would like to make them even more efficient because we see there is a large potential in preventive care, in vaccination, where we are not using the potential of the nurses who are now mostly university educated, so they have a degree. They could really be of much more use for us in general practice than they are.
Mm. I think that you're using them more efficiently. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Compared with Australian general practice. And look, I don't like making generalizations. It's not in every practice, obviously. And in Australia, there are many examples too where GPs work in multidisciplinary teams very effectively. So I don't want to make generalisations. However, it would be my observation that patients generally in Australia wish to see their GP, and if the GP says, well, the nurse can help, say, for example, with a dressing or a vaccination or something like that, then the patient sees the practice nurse after the GP. That could be actually because of our funding, because the funding for practice nurses is partly dependent on whether the GP is involved or not. But you see, in Australia, GPs, and look, it's difficult for me to tell you what the patient-GP ratio is in Australia at the moment, but I think in the Czech Republic you are looking after far greater patient populations than GPs in Australia. I wouldn't like to quote numbers because I'm going to get it wrong because it's all changed since the pandemic. But what would you say the average is?
1,000 patients per GP is probably the average, but there are some GPs who have up to 3,000 patients. And that we know is I think even 2,000, it's the border where you can really provide high-quality care, because then you only solve the acute problems, but you have no time for preventive care if you have more patients.
That's
so
right.
You only solve the...
Yeah, but in rural areas in Czech Republic where there's a really great shortage of GPs, what do you think the ratio is.
It can be up to 5,000 probably.
This is what I've seen, actually. This is what I've seen. So, but in Australia, I think it, I'm sure people will disagree with me, but I think it's around one GP to 1,000 patients, I think. Mm-hmm. But in rural areas, you know, of Australia, there's just huge access problems for patients. Mm-hmm. They just can't get any, they can't access any healthcare in Australia because of the acute shortages of doctors and other health professionals in rural areas. And but in Czech, I think you're trying very hard to address rural populations, even if, as you say, some of these populations are missing out on preventive care, but at least they're getting access to urgent care. And, you know, for example, even myocardial infarction, I sense that you've got things, you have things quite streamlined here. You know, you're using point of care testing, for example, very effectively in general practice. I don't think we're starting to do that.
Or
in Australia.
Small country. So yes. And the distance and the transport and everything is possible. So
yes.
it's actually
that's a good point.
It could work quite well. But we still have a big problem of shortages in certain areas.
I've
and
seen
the,
this, yeah.
The statistics is not very friendly. In the next decade, we are going to face large shortages in primary care, especially in children's care, but also for adult GPs.
So that's the same as in Australia, so that the predictions are very dire. Yeah. In terms of workforce shortage. So to me that makes us get back to our original topic of how we retain doctors in the workforce, because why are we seeing the shortage? Well, firstly, it's increased patient demand because of the aging population and the chronic diseases and so on, and then the recruitment of doctors as GPs. I'm not sure how you're finding it in the Czech Republic, but in Australia, we're finding it difficult to recruit GP registrars and GP trainees because they're preferring other specialties. So talking about general practice in a positive way is really important to attract new GPs, but also the retention of doctors. And a lot of doctors in Australia are thinking about alternative careers because general practice has, in the last few years, has just not been viable, and that has to do with the pandemic, but also we have high inflation and a whole range of other challenges on practices which make it just really hard to run a business. And so for that reason, a lot of doctors in Australia are thinking of considering leaving. That recently the federal government has injected a lot of money into general practice to try to incentivise bulk billing, which is where GPs only charge the Medicare rebate or the government rebate and don't charge an out-of-pocket cost. Because what the trend that we were seeing was that because general practices were not viable, that GPs were actually charging a lot of private fees and out-of-pocket costs, which in turn was making it difficult for patients, particularly from disadvantaged areas, to access general practice. So the government has intervened in that, but still we're a long way off really listening to the concerns of GPs and really addressing them in a comprehensive way.
So it's actually finances directly going from the government to the GPs to primary care. Is it a form of a grant, or how is it
actually
administered?
It's a mixed,
and what you have to do as a GP?
Yeah, it's actually a complex system and becoming even more complex, but it's a mixed system where mainly it's a fee-for-service arrangement where the doctor charges the patient a fee and the patient claims back from the government or Medicare for that doctor's fee. And in the last decade or so, a lot of GPs have been bulk billing, which means that, you know, there's an IT system which makes it easy for the doctor to help the patient with the claim from Medicare so that it's all banked directly and, you know, to make the logistics a little bit easier so that the patient's not having to pay out of their purse. But as I said, because of the financial pressures, a lot of doctors have been privately billing, which has made it financially difficult for patients. There's also another form of payment where the government pays to incentivise doctors to do chronic disease management and mental health treatment and so on, and will pay higher Medicare rebates for certain consultations, and also will pay the practice some incentives, for example, for vaccination rates and so on. So
is it really the government or is it the insurance companies?
It's the government mainly.
And
the insurance companies actually are not able to fund general practice. The insurance companies fund private hospitals only. They do have some other areas that they fund, but they're mainly focused on contracts with private hospitals rather than primary care. So that's completely different, isn't it?
Is there some pressure on the primary care to do more?
Yes.
So the private or the hospital sector may do less?
Yes, definitely.
And is this pressure developed by the government?
Yes, definitely. The government is talking about that all the time because, of course, our public hospitals have huge waiting lists. So the public hospitals have been in chaos because of the COVID, the challenges of COVID-19. And now that we're emerging from that, we have, high numbers of people with non-COVID conditions. So, you know, conditions that they have not addressed during the pandemic. So there's late diagnosis of cancer, there's, diabetes, heart disease, a whole range of issues because people have not been having their preventive health care in primary care. So this challenge is well known, and the profession and government are trying very hard to correct that imbalance. But I do have to say one thing, which is it's actually a difficult topic. We don't talk about it a lot in Australia, but I think we should, and that's that there's a very big discrepancy between the payment of GPs and the payment of specialists. So I understand in the Czech Republic, specialists might earn maybe about 30% more than GPs, maybe. 30.
It's very generalistic it depends what kind of specialty.
Yes. It depends on the numbers of patients.
If it's outpatient or if it's the clinic. If it's the clinic, you have the night duties. And if you are the head of the department and you have the night duties, so of course it's more qualified.
So it's hard to make generalisation. Yes. Mm-hmm. However, in Australia, and again, I don't have the figures, but GPs would be earning maybe three times less than a specialist. So, there's a very big discrepancy between what a private GP and a private specialist would earn in Australia.
And so, now you mean private specialist, so it's an outpatient.
An outpatient, yes, or a specialist who performs surgery in a private hospital. So in Australia we very much have two systems, the public system and the private system. So we have public hospitals and we have private hospitals. Private hospitals actually do the majority of elective surgery in Australia, and people need to be privately insured to be able to afford that care in private hospitals, although increasingly because of the access blocks in public hospitals, patients are actually self-paying. That means that they're paying thousands and thousands of dollars for their procedure, but because the waiting list is so great, some people are finding the funds to do that. Anyway, my point was that I think that if we are to motivate doctors to train as GPs in Australia, we need to actually be able to remunerate them better. And with rising inflation eating into, practice funds, it's very difficult for GPs to make a good living.
It's interesting. There are countries with very strong primary care, especially in Scandinavia. And yes. We have had some of those talking to us here also on this podcast. And it seems that in countries where primary care is very strong, so there is actually less patients in the specialized medicine, and they get high quality care that they are selected well for the indication. And so there is less over treatment and over diagnosis, and it can build up more economic safety or stability for the whole system if well balanced.
Yes.
But it is difficult to manage from inside and also from outside and from the part of the government. So I guess it's very hard to make direct comparisons between the systems. But still, I wanted to ask what's then the distribution of the patients between the GPs and the specialists on the outpatient levels. Yes. So is the referral needed, or can patients go to the specialist directly without any referral from the GP?
They need a referral from the GP if they are to claim the Medicare rebate. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have a referral, then you're not able to get the government rebate for the consultation. So most patients would, and I think that most patients would anyway go to a GP to have the first workup before they go to see a specialist. So, that hierarchy definitely exists. And GPs are the gatekeepers to the whole system.
Here in the Czech Republic, the healthcare provided is very accessible compared to many other countries.
Yes.
It's very easily accessible for everyone, basically. We tend to have many visits in primary care, more than twice as much compared to some countries where they, through the Scandinavian countries, both for pediatricians and for GPs who care for adult patients.
Yes.
So that's the extreme. The referrals are desired but are not the condition. So a patient can, even with the payment from the insurance company, go directly to the specialist, which creates a great number of over diagnosis and over-treatment, and also blocks free time for examination of patients who really need it are somehow socially or in other way in a disadvantage. So I would like to ask you, what was your, because you said in the beginning you had some experience with the Czech health system as a patient or as a co-patient, family of a patient. So what do you feel about the quality of the system from the inside? And do you have any impressions and comparisons to Australia?
I think that what I could say is that I'm impressed with the health, with the system. I think that our experience has just been, my husband's obviously had other treatments in Australia, and we haven't only depended on the Czech health system. And during the pandemic, we were unable to get here, so we weren't able to seek help over that time. But just in the limited amount of time that we have, that my husband has accessed the Czech health system, I think that we just couldn't be more impressed with the quality of care, the kindness of people, the multidisciplinary approach to care, the follow-up, and the access to advances in care, and the involvement of doctors in research and in education and training You know, so we have also had a little bit to do with, we've just observed the teaching of medical students and doctors in training, and mm-hmm. so our experience has been an overwhelmingly positive experience. Mm-hmm.
So was there anything you could criticize or you really felt annoyed by in the Czech health system?
Actually, you know, maybe I need to spend longer here because I'm looking with rose-coloured glasses. Every doctor I meet is very dedicated and working so hard, often with limited resources, to really put patient care first. Unfortunately, it's sometimes at great expense to themselves, actually. But I can only say how impressed I am. And it actually goes back to your opening comment that you'd like me to share about what, you know, share sort of learnings from Australia so that I can share what I've learned with Czech GPs. But actually I think it's the reverse, that I'm learning so much from what you're doing in the Czech Republic that I feel that I have a great deal to share with GPs in Australia now. So, yeah, I haven't got anything I could... I haven't got anything at all that I could point to that I...
I have the feeling that you are the constant learner.
It's that's
the same
true.
Thing. Yeah. So you tend to turn every situation to a learning context. What can I learn from this experience?
I think that's where my optimism comes from.
Yes, I think so. That's a way out from every crisis, by the way.
Actually, that's true, yes.
And maybe to finish this first part, could you do you have some remarks about the education of GPs? What can we pass to our young doctors from this experience you had here in the Czech health system?
Yeah, so actually another thing I was so impressed to learn about, because actually my husband and I are now members of the GP Society, so we're receiving a lot of information and newsletters from you. But one thing that I was so impressed with was the way you organised webinars for GPs through the pandemic. So wasn't it a learning time where things were changing so rapidly? Every week, I was doing a lot of vaccinations in Australia. Every week there would be something new. I was always having to learn, you know, I was looking at government websites and how do I get this information about new complications and new guidelines for the vaccination. In the Czech Republic, I think that what I saw is that every week you would have big webinars attended by thousands of GPs, because you would be sharing this new knowledge. We didn't have that in Australia, and I was so impressed you did that, because I think that empowered your GPs to really then continue to serve their populations through a really stressful time. And I heard a lot of stories about GPs in Czech Republic doing home visits and looking after patients with COVID at home, and then, of course, referring to them to hospital if they needed that. But I think that care in the community is really something to be very admired and to acknowledge the contribution of your GPs here, because I can tell you in Australia it was very uncommon for Australian GPs to visit patients with COVID at home.
It was uncommon here as well.
I think it
wasn't so many.
It was perhaps because I've visited your rural doctors. I mean, out of necessity, you had to protect yourself, because if you contracted COVID, then you weren't much good in looking after patients. So it was out of necessity that you use telehealth and so on, which is a great innovation. But I did learn from talking to many rural GPs in the Czech Republic about their enormous sacrifice, actually, and the way they risked their own health to actually serve their patient populations. And I think we need to acknowledge that, and I think we need to acknowledge the trauma that many of them went through. So maybe we can talk a little bit more about that when we talk about burnout and mental injury.
So when I get back to what we want to pass to the young doctors, it's not only the thing that they should burn out, and we will try to show how what warning actually we have for them.
Yes.
But what would you say from the educational point of view? Is there anything you could transfer, if you could, to the Czech doctor?
So maybe from my personal experience and on a really positive note, because we're talking very frankly here, we've talked about quite a number of negative things, but I actually have the view that it's really important to be frank and to talk about those things, because that's how you find the solutions. There's no point putting things under the carpet and pretending that everything is rosy and optimistic and so on. We have to confront the difficulties. But for young doctors, what I would say is I've loved being a general practitioner, and I want to continue working for as long as I can. I'm not wanting to retire. I think that's a really great sign. So for all the challenges and for all the adversity, as you say, I've learned a lot about that, and I've come through it, and now I feel that it's my legacy to actually care for younger doctors and perhaps in some ways make it a little bit easier for them. So I like to share the really positive stories and the positive things about the insights into life and to insights into families and into medicine that we achieve through a medical career, and say to younger doctors, it's worth it. It's worth it, you know. But there are a lot of challenges, and I think we need to talk openly about that. It's complex work. It's highly pressured. There are huge advances in practice coming through, which are really exciting but also quite daunting. So my other message is that as colleagues we need to do much, much more to support each other and to really strengthen our bonds through difficult challenges. And by doing that, we actually make lifelong friendships with our colleagues, which are part of the joy of a medical career. So in summary, I would highly recommend it. And to be involved in your college and your education and training, that's actually the way to meet like-minded people who can share your journey. And so by putting your hand up for a committee or, you know, an education program or a research project, when it's appropriate for you to do so, just is a great way of connecting with colleagues outside the practice and helping you sort of have some intellectual fulfillment in your work. And I'd thoroughly recommend that as well.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, and hope to hear you soon again.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.